Welcome to WBOY Presents. I'm Sean Beter. June 12th and 13th mark the second ever meeting by a national group called the Mount Vernon Assembly. Indiana Senate President Pro Tem David Long is a key leader in that organization. The aim of the group is to organize a convention of the states in order to amend the Constitution, which has never happened before. Long has admitted that getting such a convention off the ground is a long shot, but it raises some interesting questions about the nature of the Constitution, and we want to explore those issues today. Andrew Downs from the nonpartisan Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics is moderating this discussion, and he picks it up from here.
In 2013, the Indiana General Assembly passed Senate Bills 224 and 225. These bills outline how Indiana would appoint delegates to a convention called under Article 5 of the United States Constitution and the duties of those delegates. These bills are part of a plan by Indiana Senate President Pro Tem David Long to call what people are calling an Article 5 convention. Senator Long and legislators from Kansas, Ohio, and Oklahoma invited legislators from all 50 states to a meeting at Mount Vernon in December of 2013 to discuss the state-led process for amending the United States Constitution. According to reports, almost 100 legislators from 32 states attended the meeting. While there may be specific issues, such as a balanced budget amendment, deficit spending, and a federal government that is too involved in state matters that helped bring these legislators together, the December meeting was about figuring out how an Article 5 convention might work. On June 12th and 13th, the Mount Vernon Assembly, as they've come to be known, will be meeting again, this time down in Indianapolis. At this meeting, they'll be planning a conference that will draft rules and procedures for an Article 5 convention. Jeff Melanson, Assistant Professor of History, and Mike Wolf, Associate Professor of Political Science, both from IPFW, have joined us in the WBOI studios to discuss amending the United States Constitution. Jeff and Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Well, Jeff, you teach American history up to 1877. Your research area is also early American history. Mike, you teach Intro to American Politics. I'm sure you both cover the Constitution, but probably from slightly different perspectives. What is it you hope students learn about the Constitution, just sort of in general terms, after they've finished your class? Let's start with Jeff.
I try and emphasize two things. First is the idea that the founders believed that the Constitution that they had created was imperfect. They fully expected that there would be a need to amend it over time, that they fully expected, I think, that there'd be many more amendments than there actually have been over time. I think the second piece, though, that's really important in terms of what I want my students to get about the Constitution is the lack of agreement the founders had on what the Constitution was and what it meant. Almost immediately, debate started ensuing in state ratifying conventions, but especially in the first Congresses at the national level, as to what the Constitution meant, what powers Congress have. Should it be powerful government or a weak government and everything else? And so I think it's important to note that while we today think of the Constitution as this enduring, important thing, the founders themselves thought that it was an imperfect instrument.
I should point out to people that you have a way of demystifying the convention and a lot of the founding fathers and the myths that we sort of built up in our heads.
You spend enough time studying them and you realize they're human beings just like the rest of us.
Mike, what do you hope students learn in intro?
Well, in one way that it should be hard, I'm going to talk about what some of Jeff talked about, but most certainly that it should be hard to change it because as a constitution is something to operate as both a definition of what our fundamental rights are and what the structures of government are, changing that too much and legislating through changing the constitution would be a dangerous thing. Prohibition proved that one, I think. And as well, that some of the stability we've had as a country has come from the kind of firmness of the thing and the difficulty to change it. If we see the big moments of large-scale amendments, they've happened at moments of crisis in American political history. But in fact, the stability of the Constitution over time is remarkable when you consider that 1789 is also the French Revolution and France is now in the Fifth Republic. And considerable changes have occurred. So I think that there's a lot to say about some of the stability that it provides us institutionally, but also that we need to change it is exactly right. And we have this large-scale tension, particularly today in American political life, about how much this is a living constitution, how much we should be interpreting it versus maybe amending it. And that's at the base of both what our Supreme Court justices should be doing. It's now a choice of justices that has been politicized based on that, and presidential elections even. And it's important to keep in mind that these issues then are pretty fluid then.
So let's actually talk for a moment about how the Constitution is amended. Mike, let's have you do it. Lay out the couple of methods for us.
Well, the primary method has been that two-thirds of the both houses of Congress kind of initiate the process and propose this. And then it is sent to state legislatures, where three-quarters of them would ratify that. Or three-quarters of conventions at the state legislature could ratify that. That's been done once. The other has been done 26 times. What hasn't been done is the National Convention that would propose and then send to ratification through the other two processes.
So, Jeff, why were there two?
There was an expectation that under normal circumstances, Congress would be best positioned to recognize and address the defects that might arise in the Constitution. That's why 27 out of 27 amendments have come about through that process. But there was a concern in the founding period, given the legacy of the American Revolution and everything else, that if Congress was corrupt or deficient in its duties, that they would resist the effort to amend the Constitution to eliminate that corruption. And so there was the belief that it was necessary for the people to have the power to initiate change. Now, interestingly enough, at the Constitutional Convention of 1787, in the earliest part of the debates, they all recognized and agreed that there needed to be a mechanism for change. But in the early debates, it would be a state-driven process from the beginning. States would actually propose specific amendments. And when two-thirds of the states proposed the same amendment, then the ratification process would begin for those amendments. It wasn't until September 10th, so about a week before the convention actually ended, so after they'd been meeting and debating in May, June, July, August, finally in September 10th, about a week before the end, Alexander Hamilton stepped forward and said, actually, I think Congress would be better positioned to make these changes. And so it was only at that point that Congress would have a role, and it was actually not until September 15th, 2 days before the convention closed, before the Constitution was completed, that the idea of states petitioning to call a constitutional convention was actually introduced. It wasn't until the very, very end, at the last moment, when everyone was ready to leave Philadelphia, go home, and be done with this process, that this idea of states just calling a convention to have amendments was actually introduced. But it was this idea of trying to balance congressional power versus congressional corruption and the ability of the states and the people to initiate change.
Now, two questions I want to ask here. One, you talk about Congress being corrupt or unable to get its work done. This is really about them not being able to function. This is not about some fundamental flaw in the Constitution necessarily, but literally in the operation of Congress under the Constitution?
I wouldn't say. I mean, the text of Article 5 isn't so specific in terms of when a states would come forward with a constitutional convention application. But I think the expectation of most early writers on the Constitution, commentators on the Constitution, was that in normal circumstances, it would be Congress that would make these changes, that the only way we'd really need to resort to calling a convention is when Congress, there was a recognized defect and Congress refused to address it.
So the argument that some people are making today, the reason we need the Article 5 convention, that Congress is trapped in gridlock, that it's simply not doing what it's supposed to do, in some respects this lines up with at least some of the thinking of people who've studied the period.
Maybe. I think it depends on how you define corruption or deficiency in duties. Mm-hmm. I don't think the founders would describe a balanced budget amendment, for example, as in the Congress's refusal to endorse that as being a sign of corruption or a dereliction of duties. I think that that's more of an interpretation of what the best mode of governance might be. But I think you can make a very legitimate argument that there are clear deficiencies in the way government works now that Congress is refusing to address, and thus, yes, the need for an Article 5 convention.
And so the language is right. We could be talking about shades of gray here in terms of whether we've gotten far enough along that this needs to be done or not. The other thing you mentioned is that this came at the end, and we've all been in meetings where we just want the meeting to end. And so at the end, when someone proposes something new, we just all say yes in order to get out. Did that happen here?
I think that happened a lot in the Constitution. The way we elect the way the Constitution established the Electoral College, for example, was the same kind of thing. That at the very end, someone just was like, hey, we haven't come up with a good system, and Maryland has this great system for choosing state senators, so let's just kind of adapt that. The other really fun example of this is actually the preamble to the Constitution. The original preamble to the Constitution listed all of the states individually. And it was Governor Morris, who was the draftsman who went through and kind of fine-tuned the language, actually said, you know what, we should have a grander statement about the people. We, the people of the United States of America. And now, today, the preamble is taken as a central meaning of the Constitution, and this was something that was just inserted by one guy towards the very end of the process.
And it doesn't mean it was a bad idea. It's
oh, just, no, certainly.
It was kind of, it might have been debated more thoroughly if it had come up earlier in the meeting.
Correct, yeah. Correct.
Okay, so we have been talking about Article 5, and I think it might be interesting for people to actually take a look at Article 5, so I encourage people to go do that. But I'm actually going to start reading Article 5 because it is actually quite simple, and you'll see that there is more than a little bit of gray or room for interpretation here. So here we go, Article 5. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof. Now, I've stopped reading a couple of words from the end, but that is pretty close to the whole thing right there. The language does not give a lot of detail, as you pointed out earlier. So let's start with a bit of bookkeeping. Which states have actually called for a constitutional convention?
Since 1788, once the Constitution was ratified, it went into effect in 1789, but since 1788... in between to today, 49 of the 50 states have actually submitted applications to Congress calling for constitutional conventions.
And of course, the state that did not is
Hawaii,
which makes we had to know that.
And actually, one house of the Hawaii legislature did submit a petition for a constitutional convention, but the other house did not. So they got halfway there, but they're the only state who hasn't. A little bit of background on this: these calls for conventions, though, between 1789 and 1889, there were 1,300 calls to amend the Constitution in about 1,800 different ways. But only 10 of these calls were for Article 5 constitutional conventions. The other 1,290 were all proposals made in Congress by congressmen to amend the Constitution. Of these 10, 5 were in the first months of 1861 in an attempt to prevent the Civil War from breaking out. And then 3 were made in 1832, 1833 in the aftermath of the nullification crisis. So really, outside of these two crisis moments, there were only two attempts in the first 100 years of the Constitution to use this constitutional convention mechanism. Starting in 1901, though, there was a massive uptick in the number of calls for an Article 5 convention. And interestingly enough, most of these calls were single-issue calls. There was a particular issue that the people, the states, wanted Congress to address. The first issue in 1901 was the direct election of senators, and ultimately 31 states between 1893 and 1911 submitted petitions to Congress to call a constitutional convention. And some believe that the only reason Congress acted on the amendment, that Congress passed an amendment and sent it to the states, was to prevent a constitutional convention from actually being called. The numbers get tricky when you try and add up the number of different calls for constitutional conventions in the past century. Different authorities, Congress isn't actually required to keep track of this. And so it's been left to people to go through, interested individuals to go through records, state legislative records, congressional record to find this. Depending on the way you count, though, there have been at least 339 separate calls for a constitutional convention since 1901. And then one group puts the number at well over 700 calls for a constitutional convention in the history of the United States. And as of now, we obviously have not had one.
And so when we're talking about these 339 or these 700, these are actual petitions that passed both chambers of some particular state or states?
Yes, that were sent to Congress asking for a Article 5 constitutional convention. In the vast majority of these, not all of them, but in the vast majority of them, these were single-issue conventions. We want to talk about direct election of senators. We want to talk about a balanced budget. We want to talk about right to life.
And so this gets to the point you made that if it's what might be called a technical correction, there is a single issue that maybe needs to be addressed, that maybe would be better done by Congress.
Correct.
So, Mike, in when you were talking about what you hope students pick up about this when you're teaching Intro to American Politics, you talked about how you want them to understand this is difficult. This kind of makes the case for that, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, even through this method, which is less clean and easy than the congressional kickoff kind of initiation, it's hard for Congress to do it. Congress, there's 200 or some every year or every Congress that get put before Congress and never get out or never get past a committee to deal with it. And some of these are popular ones like flag burning and stuff like that that you would think would emerge eventually. So there, it's not an easy process.
Mm-hmm. And we should point out Birch Bayh, former senator from the state of Indiana, he counts as one of his great successes as a senator actually amending the Constitution in a way that allowed 18-year-olds to vote and then also dealing with who takes over if something happens to the president. So, I mean, he saw this as something that is very difficult and recognized the importance of it when it was finally done.
Well, and what's interesting, you raise him, that in the 1970s, he also was interested in amending the Electoral College.
Still is.
Yes, and one of the ways he got knocked down on that was Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan from New York, who said we should be defending the Electoral College because it's in the Constitution and it's a method, and because it has worked all this time, even if it's not worked well. We just don't want to go changing it. So his defense of the Electoral College was defending, well, we shouldn't change it because it's in the Constitution. So that's kind of remarkable to think about, the stability that some people are just wedded to, you know, keeping this as an institution as ratified.
So, Jeff, as a scholar of the time period, do you think that states should have to specify why they want a constitutional convention? Or can you have, I'll give you two scenarios, 34 states just say, we want a constitutional convention, and they don't say why. Or five states say they want it for a balanced budget amendment, and five say they want it for deficit spending, and five say they want it for something else. Till you get to 34, does this matter? Does it need to be specific?
Some legal scholars have argued that the application does need to have some level of specificity, that you only can call the convention once 34 states have petitioned on a specific issue. Other scholars argue that calling for a general convention is fine. There's one group who actually argues that, at least one group who actually argues that it doesn't matter if you have five groups that call for a balanced budget and five groups that call for a general convention and then 24 groups that just call for random other things. Their argument is that once two-thirds of the states call for any kind of constitutional convention, one needs to be held, which according to their math means that since 1908 or 1911, depending on how you look at two-thirds in the math and everything, since that time Congress has been under an obligation to call a convention, and they haven't. Mm-hmm. I would argue, based on the only real way we can interpret this question, is that based on the language of Article 5, there doesn't have to be a level of specificity. States can simply call for we need a constitutional convention to address a variety of issues. Now, rather than repeating the same point over and over again, I do want to add one addendum onto this answer that will kind of apply to a lot of the different answers throughout, which is that, as Mike alluded to at the beginning, no Article 5 convention has ever actually been called. This process has never been enacted before. It's really, as far as I can tell, the only provision of the Constitution that has never been put to the test. I'm fairly certain. I kind of did a quick overview earlier. But that means that there are no precedents. There are no laws or rules in place, and virtually everything is going to be subject to interpretation. And so I'm going to talk a lot today about the views of different scholars and different historical precedents and whatever else, but really everything is up to legitimate interpretation at this point in time. And so do states need to be specific? I would say they don't necessarily need to be, but you can make very valid arguments that they do need to have some level of specificity.
So I want to go a couple of different directions here, but I want to start with a sort of a concern about why there might be the need for specificity. What is, and Mike, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you, what would be the fear in saying we're having a constitutional convention?
Well, I think there's, for a lot of reasons, as I mentioned, some public opinion just doesn't want to go tampering with this. And you can imagine if I walked out of here and I said, I want to hold a constitutional convention, it's a flawed document, I would probably get punched in the mouth. That there is a certain level of reverence we have as Americans for this that would make, when you don't kind of go after changing a specific item like the balanced budget amendment or something that might have some popular support behind it, you would seem to, you know, be advocating some sort of sedition or something. I mean, your political opponents could immediately toss upon you your kind of anti-Americanism almost. I mean,
sure.
When you take public office or anything, you pledge an oath to the Constitution of the United States, and now you know, you're going to open it up to change. How broadly do you want that? So I think politically you could be, you know, kind of honed in on.
Mm-hmm. Jeff?
There's also a somewhat irrational fear that if you just opened up a general constitutional convention, that suddenly people are going to run to that convention and they're going to start proposing amendments that would undermine states' rights, would undermine the Republic, and would undo the Bill of Rights and things like that. And the people who express these fears are kind of losing sight of the fact that the states all still need to agree to this. The delegates in the convention, or it's not like one person's going to stand up and say, I would like to declare our national language to be Finnish and we're going to put that in the Constitution. It's not like just because one person at this convention says that this should happen, it doesn't mean that that's going to happen. But there is this irrational fear that if you open it up to a general convention, suddenly things that people don't want are going to be put into place, and it loses sight of the fact that it really still has to go through the same constitutional processes. Three quarters of the states still need to approve whatever it is this convention produces.
I really wish I knew some Finnish right now. I really, really wish I knew some Finnish right now, but I don't. So let's go with one of the issues that's been mentioned here, I think by all of us now, balanced budget amendment. Which, on the one hand, sounds like it should be a simple technical correction that would be made through the normal, or what we would consider to be the normal process Congress would initiate. But this is one of the things that people have been calling for a constitutional convention on. And so, Jeff, how many states have actually used this as their justification?
This is a really interesting question. As we mentioned a couple times previously, two-thirds of the states have to submit applications to Congress for a convention to be called, and two-thirds of 50 is 34 states right now. 34 states actually have submitted applications to Congress in various different forms. They're not the same application, but two-thirds of the states have submitted applications calling for a balanced budget amendment. But 17 of those states have subsequently rescinded or withdrawn their applications. Now, they've withdrawn their applications out of fears of what Mike and I were actually just talking about, of that the scope of a constitutional convention couldn't be limited to this, fears that the scope couldn't be limited to discussion of this single topic.
Okay, so let me ask you to jump in here quickly. Are they allowed to rescind?
That's actually a point of contention.
Okay.
And I'll actually come back to that point of contention so we don't lose the train of thought here. But part of the reason that these 17 states started rescinding or withdrawing their applications for a convention is that several former Supreme Court justices actually started talking about the fact that the scope can't be limited. Once you call a convention, everything would be on the table. And these states got concerned that their single issues could be lost in the shuffle of a broad convention. And so states actually started issuing, especially in the years from 2000 to 2010, states started issuing blanket rescissions of we're going to withdraw any proposals for constitutional convention amendments that we've ever issued before. We're withdrawing all of them because we don't want to have an out-of-control convention. Six of those states have subsequently, though, resubmitted new applications for a balanced budget Article 5 convention, putting the number of states with active applications at 23.
And two of them just this year, right? Or last year? It's very recent. I know we were talking about that before the show came on. And Michigan in 2014, Ohio in 2013. So this is...
And actually, Louisiana, just 2 weeks ago, May 15th, 2014, submitted a new application for a balanced budget amendment. So this is something that is on the minds of the states, even beyond groups like the Mount Vernon Assembly.
And the Mount Vernon Assembly has specifically mentioned this as one of the issues that sort of drawn them together, but they're trying to avoid those issues and instead look at the mechanism by which this would be done. I want to ask you both to play attorneys for a moment here, and we'll use the usual disclaimer that you are not attorneys. However, I'm going to ask you to play attorney anyway and interpret something for me. It says here that Congress shall call a convention for proposing amendments which in either case shall be valid, et cetera, et cetera. It says Congress shall call. Yet, Jeff, you've already made the argument on behalf of a different organization, obviously, that you got more than 34 states that have already called for something. And whether states are allowed to rescind or not, we have more than 34, or we've hit the number 34 for a balanced budget amendment. Do you think Congress actually has leeway here?
I would argue that they really don't, although it obviously a lot's going to depend on how you count what the applications mean. Do they have to be specific, or is it any applications? And it also depends on how you count the rescissions or withdrawals. But the founders themselves, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, in the Federalist Papers, both said that shall was binding. Congress shall call a convention, that once the two-thirds of the states submitted their applications, then Congress was legally bound to do it. Some legal scholars, constitutional scholars, have taken to referring to Congress's role as a ministerial or a clerical one, meaning that they were simply fulfilling a function that is prescribed for them to follow through on. With that being said, there's no enforcement mechanism if Congress doesn't actually follow through on this. The example, not that it's a recent example, but in 1910, after the 1910 census, Congress has an constitutional obligation to engage in reapportionment for the House of Representatives. In 1910, after the census, Congress didn't do it. People said, hey, Congress, you should be engaging in reapportionment. And Congress said, oh, well. There were no dire consequences. Holes in the floor didn't open up and swallow the congressman who refused to do it. There was no negative consequence here. And so even though we can argue that there is that they're supposed to do it, they're obligated to do it, there's no guarantee that they would actually follow through on it.
Mike, do you think this particular Congress has an appetite to debate the meaning of the word shall?
I don't know. I mean, I think Congress... many members of Congress would let this go. I think politically they would love to have this. So I'll leave it at that because I know we want to talk a little bit more of the congressional role. But I don't think Congress will have a problem with this occurring. I think politically it's in some ways, particularly for many of them, it would be a popular thing to go. What would happen? Who gets to decide? Is this the Supreme Court, who interprets the Constitution, be able to decide whether or not their interpretations of the Constitution will allow for a constitutional amendment? I mean, this is a dog chasing its tail in a way. That's a very interesting.
And then we go back to the fact that there is no enforcement mechanism anyway. So even if Congress says, no, we're not going to, in spite of the word shall, and the Supreme Court says, yes, you are, there's nothing that says Congress has to do it then either.
And interestingly, the First Amendment offered among the amendments to the Constitution was actually, to Jeff's point, to make sure that the apportionment of Congress followed a population number, and it didn't get ratified. It's still hanging out there, and it could just be directly ratified, by the way. It does not need another initiation process. So tomorrow we could ratify what was Amendment Number 1, and we would have then a 6,000-person member of the House of Representatives. But something needs to be, to this point, without this constitutional fix, though, to bring a little politics into this, I think much of the problems that Congress has right now is the size of the House of Representatives not changing since after 1910. And so we have,
you want 6,000 members in there?
I don't want 6,000, but, at least there's some mechanism of something. Without it, with the interpretation, I think this is what some of the people that want to firmer amendments say, then you are flying blind.
Just one quick historical fact. The most recent amendment to the Constitution, the 27th Amendment on Congress passing raises for itself, was actually the second original amendment proposed along with that First Amendment on congressional apportionment. And it was adopted and ratified in 1992 after being on the books, open for debate and discussion for 202 years, 7 months, and 12 days. And out of the blue, the three-quarter state ratified it, and all of a sudden the Constitution was amended again.
And it's interesting. I just want to add an important political science point to this. The person that really led the charge to push it over the edge was former student. He had graduated from the University of Texas in political science and written a paper, a term paper, about the fact that it only needed to be ratified. And he got a C on the paper from his political science professor because she said, oh, no, that's not correct, or that's impossible, or whatever. And he got so fired up that he went and just got the final few states because it had sort of been ratified by different states over time. And boom, it went. So an important note, don't believe your political science professor. there is a way for that. So maybe if you really want a 6,000-person House of Representatives, you can get on it and get that thing done.
Well, we're actually going to spend a little time talking about several things that Congress will do or should do or may do. I mean, we don't really know how this is supposed to work. But for right now, we're going to take a little break, and we will be right back. Welcome back. My name is Andy Downs. I'm the director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IPFW. I'm in the studio right now with Jeff Melanson from the Department of History and Mike Wolf from the Department of Political Science, both from IPFW. We're actually talking about amending the Constitution, and we're doing it because on June 12th and 13th down in Indianapolis, a group known as the Mount Vernon Assembly will be getting together to talk about how an Article 5 convention might work if one were called. And that's when the states actually petition Congress to hold a convention where the Constitution is amended. When we left, we were talking about whether Congress had an option when it comes to actually calling the convention. And the decision was basically no, they probably don't, although there's no enforcement mechanism. But the word shall pretty much means they have to do it. Jeff, you referred to their duties as being ministerial or clerical, quoting someone else, of course. And so in some respects, it sounds like all they do is call the convention and that's it. But I cannot imagine that is all they will want to do.
Yeah, I mean, most legal scholars believe that Congress has virtually no leeway in how this would actually work. One has argued that the only power they have is literally to just confirm that 34 applications have been made and to say now a constitutional convention will happen. Most think that it's reasonable to assume that Congress could set a date and set a location to help in the clerical duty of making this thing take place. And the assumption in this case is that most rulemaking in terms of how the convention would actually operate would be left up to this, either the states submitting their applications, that is part of the application saying we want a constitutional convention to discuss a balanced budget amendment and here are the rules under which this convention would operate, that if all of the states submitted the same rules that Congress would be required to adopt those rules. And the other prominent viewpoint is that it would simply be left up to the convention once called to set its own rules. That's what the constitutional convention did in 1787. They spent the first couple of days essentially agreeing upon how they would work and that this is how it might work today. Now, interestingly enough, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, found the convention idea to be problematic, especially the way it was presented in the Constitution, due to the, quote, vagueness of the terms. How is a convention to be formed? By what rule decide? What the force of its acts? End quote. And he said at a later point that the vagueness that in, quote, in constitutional regulations ought to be as much as possible avoided. And yet this vagueness is now at the heart of a lot of the debates over how this kind of convention could work. Now, Congress has claimed more power than this, though, in the past. In the 70s and 80s, the Senate actually passed two different bills to try and regulate this. They referred in 1971 and 1983, the Federal Constitutional Convention Procedures Act, although the House never acted on either. And between 1973 and 1992, 22 separate bills were introduced in the House and 19 separate bills were introduced in the Senate looking to establish these kinds of procedures. Obviously, none of these have passed, but they do represent an important reference point for determining how might Congress try and regulate a convention. Now, Andy, you read the language of Article 5 earlier, and it doesn't seem to give Congress much leeway. But so far, we've talked a lot about shall call, and Congress has actually put a lot of emphasis on the call. Once the legislators of two-thirds of the several states shall call a convention. And Congress has said that the word call, kind of like debating the meaning of is, that the word call provides a broad mandate to Congress. And they've interpreted this broad mandate to include setting the place and time of a convention, determining the nature of the amendments that would be considered, determining the number and apportionment of delegates. In many of the versions that the Senate passed, there would be 535 or 538 delegates, each delegate with a single vote. The difference in number is whether or not you allow delegates from Washington, D.C. to participate in the convention. And this would actually go against the way the original constitutional convention worked, where each state got a single vote. Some of these laws actually provide that the convention would be funded with monies from the federal budget, that delegates to the convention would be paid by the federal government while they were in session. And it also would allow them to determine convention procedures, including a deciding vote, namely that it would be take a vote of two-thirds of the delegates to actually pass an amendment. And then finally, they would be allowed to place a time limit on the convention. Most versions were either 6 months or a year.
This is interesting, and I do want to point out a couple of things people may want to go look for. In 2014, a gentleman named Thomas Neal, who did some research for the Congressional Research Service, actually put out a publication called The Article 5 Convention to Propose Constitutional Amendments, Contemporary Issues for Congress. This is actually includes a summary of some of what Jeff was talking about there, but it does very much make the case for Congress's case about how it would exert some authority. And then there's also, I think, a fairly accessible piece in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy from 2007, written by James Kenneth Rogers, called The Other Way to Amend the Constitution, the Article 5 Constitutional Convention Amendment Process. Mike, as somebody who follows Congress, I think it's safe to say that Congress doesn't really like to give over too much control quite often. And so this interpretation seems pretty predictable almost. But really, shall call does sound very ministerial and clerical, that, you know, here's the date, good luck, conventioneers, you figure out what you're going to do. How would Congress handle a ruling from, say, the Supreme Court, do you think, that says no, or hinting from the Supreme Court that their responsibility here is very clerical?
You know, I don't know. I do think Congress would punt. I don't think that they would put up much of a fight, to be honest. I mean, Congress hates Congress. The American public hates Congress. People win seats in Congress by running against Congress. So the last thing you'd want to be doing is like holding to, I think each individual member would quickly defect from kind of an institutional defense. In the 1970s and early 1980s, we had a different Congress where there was a lot more kind of overlap ideologically and people seriously looking at these issues. I mean, they can't do anything right now. They are so locked up that I imagine, you know, there would be a political benefit for many of them kind of saying, yeah, let's do this thing and handing the ball off quickly. So I don't know if there would be an institutional defense, even though there probably should for the you know, Article 1 of the Constitution and all these matters. But I don't know if in real political, if this thing caught heat, that you wouldn't have a lot of people just want to hand off.
And we should keep in mind that for a number of the organizations that are saying we need this right now, they're actually citing Congress's approval rating as evidence that it is dysfunctional, that it's not working, that it maybe is deficient and therefore needs to be moved in some direction by the Constitutional Convention or a Constitutional Convention. But also, this is something that seems to be much more popular among conservative members of the Republican Party or conservatives in general who are not affiliated with parties. So I suppose you could say that some of the folks who've come in the last few years who are maybe a little more conservative would actually say, hey, we're calling it. It's on this date at this location. Good luck. See you later.
Absolutely. I do think that a lot of the push is probably from the conservative angle. And some of these issues, by the way, I mean, Congress has, after the 1994 elections, certainly looked at the own institution and did purposeful things to kind of weaken components of the U.S. Congress. And one of which also, by the way, was to almost nearly pass a balanced budget amendment, which would significantly limit Congress's role. I mean, the first lines of Article 1, Section 8 are basically, here's how to go into debt, here's how to fund that debt. I mean, we always have been dealing with this, and it's the congressional powers to actually how to do this. So I don't think that you wouldn't quickly see members kind of lining up and volunteering to be delegates, probably, mm-hmm. that thing.
Or paid employees, as was mentioned earlier. I know I'm putting my application in. So Jeff, how do you suppose the issues would be identified that will be discussed? And I suppose let me back up for a second, because conventions were not uncommon back during the founders' period. They may have been intrastate as opposed to interstate conventions, but this was not something they were unfamiliar with.
No, I mean, the founders held conventions quite regularly. I mean, part of that was that there wasn't, during the American Revolution, there wasn't a formalized government. And so as much as they took to calling them Continental Congresses, the Congress didn't have any actual legal authority. So it really was just a convention. And when it came time to write the Constitution, they decided to call a convention. When it came time to ratify the Constitution, they called for ratifying conventions. And so this was something that they were very used to. In terms of how the issues would come forward, that's one of the most important subjects of debate over how this would actually work. As we alluded to this earlier, the idea that there's this debate over, once three-quarters of the states petition for a balanced budget amendment constitutional convention, does that then mean that the convention is limited to only talking about a balanced budget amendment? Or does it mean that once a constitutional convention is called, even if it's called for a specific purpose, if all issues are suddenly on the table?
And this, of course, is one of the great fears.
And this is
even if you
fear.
Had the issues clearly defined, we're only going to talk about X. Once you got there, everything's on the table.
I mean, this is the great fear. But for example, I mean, a minute ago we were talking about that it tends to be conservative groups who are pushing for a constitutional convention, and that they're primarily looking at things like balanced budget and controlling the federal legislature. But in May 2nd, 2014, the Vermont state legislature actually submitted a petition, an application to Congress to call an Article 5 constitutional convention, essentially to overturn Citizens United, in order to regulate election campaign donations and expenditures and to end the legal concept of corporate personhood. This is what they want to amend the Constitution to do. So you imagine that even if Vermont doesn't get on the balanced budget amendment train, and I'm fairly certain that Vermont won't, Vermont would be at the convention. This would still be a convention of 50 states. It wouldn't be a convention of the 34 states who wanted to talk about this issue. And you have to believe that if the delegates from Vermont had, the Vermont's legislature had felt strongly enough about ending corporate personhood, that the delegates at this constitutional convention would want that to be on the agenda. And one of the real debates that exists over over an Article 5 convention is, can you limit the scope of debate? Is that possible to do that ahead of time? Can you say it's a single-issue convention, or is once it's open, the whole thing is open?
And actually, limiting debate, that's not only about the subject matter, but it's also about the rules of debate. How many minutes for this, how many minutes for that? Mike teaches a class on special interest groups and actually does a classroom exercise where he has the class function as Congress, or a couple committees in Congress, and they function with open rules and closed or open debate and closed debate. And Mike, what do students, these people who are among those of us who say we don't like Congress, what do the students do when they're put in the position of being members of Congress and they're given the rules by which they're going to operate?
Well, they follow the incentives of the rules, and that's why such things are so important in the establishment of this. And I know that some states that are part of this are taking great care to talk about the rules and how you remove people and this kind of thing. And that's an extraordinary point, because the rules in high-stakes things like this provide incentives for both positive and sometimes perverse actions, right? And so you can use the rules to yank things around. So I think that's one of the big components about what's going to happen in Indianapolis is really important to keep your eye on, even though it seems like, well, you're not dealing with the substantive. It actually has a lot to do with what would be occurring.
So when you say positive and perverse, give some examples of what you think might fall into those categories.
I'm afraid to go there. You wanted me to be a lawyer earlier.
That's right.
Already, then you're
I'm
talking
very demanding.
About changing the Constitution. I am going to get punched when I walk out of here. So I don't know if I want to go into that. But certainly, I mean, removing somebody who might be voicing something big, certainly some of the issues we've talked about, flag burning, term limits, balanced budget amendment, might have real already behind them popular support. Whether or not they should be adopted is another issue. But some of the bigger questions of the U.S. Constitution that would or could be raised, like the vagueness of the Second Amendment that talks about presidential power, that they purposely left vague for some of the reasons Jeff talked about, the disagreement about how powerful a president should be, and knowing George Washington would be the first president and he'd set the precedent. Well, that's not in the Constitution, and we struggle with presidential power these days, and it would be nice to set some definitions and limitations and more specificity to the office. Mm-hmm. But it's incredibly unlikely to think that this, you know, kind of convention would actually address something like that when, you know, these other issues are hanging out there.
And I do want to read something from the resolution that was actually passed by the Mount Vernon Assembly back in December of 2013. This is just one snippet. People should go to their website to actually see the entire resolution. But it says here, the purpose of this meeting the one that will be taking place in Indianapolis, will be to plan a three-day conference in December of 2014, and that conference will draft language for proposed rules and procedures by which any Article 5 convention for proposing amendments would operate. And so they seem to be functioning under this assumption that if perhaps every state submits the exact same petition to Congress, Congress will, for perhaps just general political reasons, feel pressure to then say, okay, those are the rules by which we will operate. But really, there's nothing that says who sets the rules.
I mean, I would say that I would hope that there will be a provision in whatever, assuming the rules aren't just left up to the convention to decide. And if they are, and 34 states have sent this in and Congress says, we're calling a convention, figure out your own rules, the assumption is that the 34 states who'd endorsed the Mount Vernon Assembly's rules would just go to the convention and endorse those rules then, and they would, those rules would be set. But I would hope that people would have enough foresight, much like the founders did, to recognize that whatever we come up with isn't going to address all circumstances, mm-hmm. and that there would be some mechanism in place to adopt new rules or adapt the existing rules agreed upon at the beginning during the convention for the circumstance that, oh, this issue came up and we didn't anticipate this issue coming up, and under the rules we have no way of resolving this issue, so now we're either deadlocked or we're going to fall apart, or we need to revise the rules to accomplish this.
And this is where we start to run into trouble, though, because if states have said we will recall our delegates if they behave inappropriately, perversely perhaps, to use Mike's language from earlier, how do you define perverse? You know, just because a circumstance was not conceived of before the convention and some new understanding was built at the convention, is that person now behaving inappropriately and need to be recalled? It's an interesting question, and to imagine having officials there who would make this judgment call and pull a delegate out seems to be interesting and perhaps even impossible.
I mean, I would think to a certain extent it would end up being a recipe for disaster, because you're going to end up with a circumstance where states are going to be reviewing daily transcripts and saying, we don't like what this delegate said, so we're pulling him home or her home. Or you're going to have the presiding officer of the convention sitting in the front with the gavel, listening intently to each delegate speaking. And as soon as they say something that that particular person thinks is out of bounds, rap, 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 you're out of order. You need to sit down now. Or my favorite version is that you'd have someone sitting on off the stage with a giant hook. And as soon as someone said something inappropriate, the giant hook would come out, pull them off stage, and the next speaker would start. But this is why I think it's important to have the convention have the ability to adapt the rules over time, is that it's fine in theory to say debate is going to be limited to these particular issues, but what happens when someone starts talking about other things? I mean, the other thing I think we need to...
Irrelevant other things.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other important thing to keep in mind here is that 34 states are going to get together and call for a balanced budget amendment constitutional convention that will be open to 50 states. 14, 15, 16 states won't agree with the need for this amendment, won't agree for calling this amendment, but they're going to go and they're going to look to make this either undermine the convention, or they're going to look, hopefully you'd hope they would look to do other productive things with the convention. Let's see if we can come up with productive solutions to problems. But all of a sudden, then you're potentially going beyond the bounds of the limited convention, and then you're running up against your rules, and suddenly the whole thing is a political farce that's not going to accomplish anything.
But you know, you could actually use the rules to slow the thing down and not necessarily be doing anything that is heinous and awful and turning it into a farce. I doubt they will allow filibuster at a convention, but there are rules by which legislative bodies operate that allow people to take advantage of situations, slow things down, maybe give time to build political will to go in a different direction.
Well, I think a good example of this is, even if you take for granted that we're going to call a constitutional convention, it's going to be limited to conversation about a balanced budget amendment. All right, great. We all agree on that going in. Well, how do you go about, what if in your conversations about a balanced budget amendment, you realize that there are actually deeper problems with the Constitution that can really go towards strengthening this idea of the balanced budget amendment? So, for example, in any conversation about a balanced budget amendment, taxation is going to become a critically important issue. So what if delegates wanted to eliminate the amendment providing for an income tax? What if they wanted to amend the income tax to be a constitutional requirement that it's now a flat tax? What if we wanted to propose a new amendment allowing for a national sales tax? Or what if we said, you know what, these deficit and imbalanced budget issues really came about because of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, which weren't actually wars because Congress didn't declare them. We just spent more than a decade in these places without a declaration of war. Let's go in and change the War Powers Act. Let's go and change the ability for Congress to declare war or require the president to ask for a declaration of war, and let's strengthen that. Or let's say we wanted to have an enforcement mechanism. Congress is going to get punished. Congress is going to get taken to the woodshed if they don't abide by the balanced budget amendment, which means that we need to give the president new powers, or we need to give the judiciary new powers. These are all things directly relevant to a balanced budget amendment that are within the realm of the rules, but that's going to make the convention slow down. It's going to slow things down. It's going to make the convention, to a certain extent, you'd think, go off the rails. If we get into a debate about the income tax, or if we get into a debate about the war power of Congress, they're relevant, but not what I think a lot of the people are expecting to talk about.
Let alone getting to a level of detail that, as Mike pointed out, is maybe better suited for legislation as opposed to what the Constitution should be in terms of these broad strokes of what should be going on. So, Mike, do you think we can avoid a runaway convention?
It's hard to imagine. I mean, all the points Jeff raises lead people who would be in a good faith effort to get to the bottom of stuff to really have to uncover where the complexities of these interconnections are. So it would be difficult to see how you wouldn't really start to be yanking strings that yanked other strings, right? But mm-hmm. at the same time, I mean, it's the kind of approach here should be lauded in one way, because one of the biggest debates we talked about in American political life right now is whether the Constitution should be interpreted broadly by the Supreme Court to provide rights or to define institutional powers of the federal government. And it's been a really contentious point. And those that believe that the original framing of the Constitution, problematic as it may be, as Jeff raised, they're directly trying to do that. One of their big arguments is the way to change a constitution and what the meaning of constitutional freedoms and institutional powers are is through the amendment process. And you should be doing this. And so I think at some level, the difficulties and the real clear problems that are part of this, it also should be mentioned that people like Senator Long should be kind of commended for putting his money where his mouth is, rather than a lot of other people who say we shouldn't be interpreting the Constitution and then go ahead and have big interpretations on some of the issues that Jeff raised, like Citizens United or something. So this, I think, for a lot of people is important for a broader set of debates about contemporary politics that are kind of tripping us up.
You know, I think there's a little doubt that there will be litigation at some point in this process. And in some respects, we're already there, because the states that have attempted to rescind, there's some question whether they have the legal authority to do that, right, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, the rescission controversy is fascinating. There are groups who say that once a state submits an application to Congress for a constitutional convention, that application is binding, that a state can't withdraw it. And the precedent they point to for that is when the 14th Amendment was being debated after the Civil War. Several states approved the 14th Amendment and then subsequently rescinded their approval of the 14th Amendment. And the Secretary of State said, nope, we're counting their approvals as being approvals. And if their approvals are counted, then the amendment has passed. And Congress the very next day said, nope, their rescissions don't matter. They approved the amendment. The 14th Amendment is now binding. Now, it is a legal precedent. But it's a legal precedent dealing with citizenship rights for African Americans. It's dealing with due process of law. It's a debate that's taking place at a really heightened moment in the nation's history. And so while it is a precedent, it's not necessarily the precedent you want to go to when arguing that rescissions aren't allowed, I would kind of argue.
Hey, Mike, how should the public interpret litigation? If we end up with a lot of lawsuits regarding the calling of a convention, in other words, Congress says, oh, we get to establish the rules, some states sue and say, no, you don't, how should the public view that?
You're making me a lawyer again, right?
I am. So, I'm making you a lawyer.
No, I do think that—
But a political scientist.
They're not going to
well.
Like, on one level, they're not going to like the front end being packed with cleaning up the legal components of this and all these challenges. But at the back end, it might, if this were, if it ends up being a serious effort and a serious convention, it's very important that some of these things are dealt with at the front end. Otherwise, you end up with people, if states are allowed to start yanking people or different kind of aspects of it are questioned later, then it really, anything that would come out of it could really be questioned. And trying to get to the 3/4 of states to ratify, they would simply impeach it by the procedural component. So probably unpopular, but important to clean up the messes before it really got going.
And we should point out that it's not like this thing was uncontroversial when, or unanimously supported when passed originally, the Constitution itself. But at the same time, people said, okay, that's the Constitution, and we moved on. Do we have that kind of attitude today, do you think, that we could agree, yeah, okay, that's what was passed, let's go?
It's fascinating because with most constitutional questions, we talk about original intent. What did the founders mean? And we lose sight of the fact that the founders themselves didn't know what they meant with most things. But we have the ability to go back and look at the founders' interpretations, and then we also have the ability to look at how have implementation of different constitutional provisions evolved over time. For example, the way the presidents are elected has evolved significantly over time, especially to the degree to which we hand the process over to political parties. Or the original meaning of the Second Amendment meant one thing in 1789, and it means something very different in 2014. The understanding of that has evolved over time and can continue to evolve over time. Article 5 has no process of evolution directly. We can look to state constitutional conventions. We can look to other lawmaking processes. We can look to other kinds of precedents. But there are going to be lots of conflicting interpretations based on very little evidence. And the only real way to resolve these controversies with any sort of real decisive conclusion is to turn, as Mike said, is to turn it over to the ultimate arbiter of the Constitution, the Supreme Court. And it's going to be better to do this at the front end so we can have a common ground from which to actually engage in an honest process than to try and figure it out after the process has been carried through on.
So how would votes be cast at the convention?
That's a completely unknowable question to a certain extent. Some groups argue that it should be by state. I believe that the Mount Vernon Assembly's current operating version is that each state would get 6 delegates, but each state would have a single vote, so there'd be 50 votes. As I mentioned earlier, the laws that the Senate passed that the House didn't act upon called for 535 delegates, each with their own vote, and that delegates would be proportional to state population. So California would have the most delegates. Wyoming would only have 3 delegates. But it's really until someone, you know, until the Mount Vernon Assembly gets the Congress to agree to their version, or until Congress steps forward and says this is what the procedures are going to be, it's really impossible to know how that part of it would really function, how most parts of it would actually function in real practice.
Mike, in terms of your knowledge of Congress, et cetera, and political culture, what do you think would be the winning scenario here?
Well, I think, you know, states are going to come with very different, with the political science research right now on different state legislatures who have hold a lot of sway here are very different on what people imagine the role of representatives are. It's very split right now between red states and blue states, but historically that's been the case anyway about how representation, what it means. And for something like this, you'd have a different set of patterns for these choices depending on the state. So that's something to keep in mind in how states would overall, for if they had to approve anything out of there, if they viewed the process of who was chosen from some sets of states as problematic, that would be where there would be a sticking point. You know, so then you could have Minnesota say, I don't really like how Alabama chose their people. It's a false thing that went, and boom, you'd have a problem right there. The way around that is to be careful at the front end and maybe try to set some precedent. I think centered along by continuing to hold these things is maybe trying to do that. And the fact that Indiana is kind of already adopted some things, maybe provide a precedent for other states to follow, if it's a good precedent. I don't know. With the politics of it, though, are very real. Mm-hmm.
So here's the last question for both of you, and it kind of gets at a fundamental point here. Is Congress, is the executive branch broken? Jeff?
I don't think that there is anything fundamentally wrong with the constitutional system in place. It's functioned for well over 200 years, and it's functioned reasonably well for well over 200 years. I think that the political parties have broken the system, and this is really more Mike's area of expertise, but I think that it's the people in power and their refusal to compromise, and really I would argue their refusal to govern, that is the problem here, and it's not so much the constitutional system itself. I'm not sure a balanced budget amendment would actually resolve the fundamental flaw that exists right now, because I don't think it's a constitutional flaw, but that's my argument as a historian of the early republic.
Yeah, blowing up the party system usually is what we do every 30 to 60 years, and that might be the way around this. We've tried big things before, like a balanced budget amendment that would have balanced the budget within 6 years of its 1995 passage had it done. And in fact, we had nearly a balanced budget at the federal level without it in 4 to 5 years. So, you know, Americans have to trust each other as citizens and trust each other that we could both take on big questions like this and deal with constitutional stuff, but also that we can do stuff through the political realm as well.
That's all the time we have for this edition of WBOY Presents. Our thanks to Andy Downs, Mike Wolf, and Jeff Melanson, and to IPFW as well. This program is produced by Katie Anderson and myself. I'm Sean Beter. We'll see you next time on WBOY Presents. And this is 89.1 WBOY Fort Wayne HD Channel 1, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios and online at WBOY.org.